This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In the rush for intelligence after the attacks on 9/11, many American interrogators used fear and control, confrontation and domination to try to get crucial information from suspects in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Guantanamo Bay. In some cases, even more extreme measures were authorized, techniques like waterboarding, which many regard as torture. Their effectiveness and legality remain controversial, and the publication of pictures of prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib proved disastrous. Afterwards, a new crop of interrogators tried a new approach: negotiation, respect, psychological manipulation. The story of how they worked, how they succeeded, and how some in the U.S. military resisted them is told in a new book, How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Used Brains, Not Brutality, to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. The co-author is an interrogator who writes under the pseudonym Matt Alexander. If you have questions about interrogations, what works, what doesn't, if you've been an interrogator, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the hour, NPR's ombudsman will join us to talk about NPR's corporate underwriting and complaints about a paid announcement for the Department of Homeland Security. But first, how to break a terrorist. Matthew Alexander writes under that pseudonym because of security concerns. We should also mention he's got a co-author, John Bruning. Matthew Alexander is with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
And we should also identify the deadliest man in Iraq from your book title. That's Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq, the man who blew up the Golden Mosque in Samarra and fomented the worst of the violence between Sunnis and Shias. You got there, what, about a month after that attack?
Yes, I arrived in Iraq in March of 2006. Violence was at its peak. Zarqawi was being fairly successful in his quest to start a civil war between Sunni and Shia in Iraq. You know, I call Zarqawi in the book the preacher of hate. This was a man who was very extreme in his ideals. Early on in his life, he had been a criminal. You know, he spent time in a Jordanian prison for sexual assault, among other crimes. And then he converted to Islam, an extreme brand of Islam, while in prison. I went to Afghanistan, and he eventually ended up in Iraq prior to our invasion.
And you should not be described or confused in any way with somebody who is a, was there in penny loafers.
No. And, you know, Zarqawi was, ultimately, he was not an intellectual. In fact, he was illiterate for most of his life. Unlike a lot of other al-Qaeda leaders, he had not memorized large portions of the Quran until very late in life. And he espoused a version of Islam that was very extreme. In fact, in the book, I tell stories about how the Sunni Iraqis that we interrogated often were very easy to bring back out of that because they didn't espouse in it. They even saw it as very radical.
And indeed, later on, we saw messages from Ayman al-Zawahiri, number two in al-Qaeda, saying, hey, you got to stop killing quite so many Shias here and Muslim civilians. And indeed, one of the things you ran into in terms of resistance from other people that when you got to Baghdad was this assumption that all of these dissidents that were being picked up, all these detainees, were hardcore al-Qaeda who had cut off all relations from their families and didn't want to have any truck with anybody.
Yeah, I think this was a false perception we made about Sunni Iraqis. They were not extremists.
For
the most part. There were some, no doubt. But in the book, you know, I talk about, the first story I talk about is a man named Abu Ali. And Abu Ali, the first thing he said to me is, if I had a knife, I would cut your throat. Abu Ali was a Sunni imam, and he had been forced to flee his home and give up his business because of Shia militias that had threatened him and killed one of his friends. But he joined al-Qaeda not because he believed in the ideology. He joined out of a need for protection. And he said to me, ultimately, something that stuck with me, which is that you Americans forced us to do this. You gave us no choice. You didn't protect us from the Shia militias, and al-Qaeda could. So.
And they were the force that did protect them, did something to protect them, and they found themselves caught up in this. Others even caught up in it simply for the money.
Yeah, I tell another story about a man named Abu Gamal, who we caught in a house full of suicide bombers. And through some very innovative ways, of interrogating and using new methods of interrogation that relied on a knowledge of Arab culture, I was able to convince him to sell out his cause. But this is a man who joined Al-Qaeda because he had a second wife he couldn't afford. She had a shopping habit. We used to say she, you know, she loved the blue jeans and bling. And he ultimately had joined Al-Qaeda because he needed to pay bills. His business wasn't doing well, and his wife was spending a lot. And when I realized what motivated him, what truly motivated him, was his loss of respect for himself. And I offered him a way to get that back.
And
he became cooperative.
And that way, and this is not to suggest that you come from a criminal investigation background, and one of the tricks you used, ruses, if you will, was to print a fake divorce decree that he could then take to say, I divorce my second wife. I can then have my self-respect, and therefore I will give you some information in return for this because you've been so kind to me.
That's correct. And, you know, but the important part of this, it's not the ruse. You know, there's an infinite number of ruses and trickery that we can use. In the criminal investigative world, we have a whole list of these things that we use. The important part is the way you adapt that to the culture of the person that you're interrogating. That same ruse would not have worked most likely on an American.
Yeah, and there's another case, a man named Abu Ali, which means father of Ali, who denied he had a son.
That's correct, and I was very puzzled by this. You know, you don't often find somebody, some Iraqis take on names of Abu without being a father, but it just didn't strike, didn't hit right with me. And it turns out we were right. His friend later told us that he did have a son named Ali, and he had been hiding that from us, you know. And I tell a story in the interrogation, the last interrogation I did with Abu Ali, in which I said to him, you know, you need to think about the future of Iraq and the future of your son. And, you know, you can't live in the past. Us Americans, we've made mistakes here, no doubt. We've put you in a tough situation. But we're willing to work with you now. I'm extending a hand to you, a friendship for the future of Iraqis, for Sunnis and Americans to work together. And that appealed to him. And ultimately, he gave us a target location, a house, where we captured the man who delivered Zarqawi.
Later delivered Zarqawi, the so-called group of five. These were people who were very puzzling, and you spend much of the book parsing out how you then tracked from them up the chain of command to Zarqawi and eventually to his demise. And the final ruse, the final piece of trickery was to convince one of his lieutenants, as it turned out, a guy you already held, that in fact you were there as a recruiter to build up the Sunnis in Iraq to fight eventually against Iran, and he could help you with this. And well, there were conspiracies underway, and you can't trust everybody. You can only trust me, but we'll find out what's going on here.
Yeah, Abu Haider was an interesting character. This is the man who ultimately gave us the information that led to Zarqawi. I describe him as the Hannibal Lecter of Al-Qaeda. He was manipulative. He was extremely intellectual, very smart. He was very thoughtful, articulate. And he had, for three weeks, he had foiled our interrogators who had tried to control him. And he was on his way to be shipped out to another prison. And it came down to a matter of 6 hours that I had with him to try and convince him to sell out his cause. And that 6 hours, I spent the first 5.5 hours just getting to know him, stroking his ego, figuring out how to convince this guy to sell out his cause. And ultimately, in the last 30 minutes, I was able to do that with a little bit of a gamble, a little bit of a risk, and a lot of knowledge about Iraqi and Arab culture.
And part of the risk was, in fact, that your superiors would find out what was going on. You were somewhat off the reservation here. And in fact, your career was at risk because there was great resistance to some of these ideas. Some of the people there in Baghdad with you at time, including some of those who were your bosses, didn't want you to try these techniques, even when they had proved successful.
That's correct. And, you know, I think in the past, the harsh methods had some success at some point, and so they were very reluctant to abandon them and to see that there was better ways to do this. And to their defense, I was fairly new to Iraq. You know, I'd only been there a couple months when all this was going on. And so I think it took some time for me to earn their trust. But ultimately, they did. I did earn their trust because of the successes we had. But in the case of Abu Haider, you know, I had to make a decision, and I think it was a leadership decision about career first or mission first. And I chose to put the mission first. I believed in my gut that Abu Haider could lead us to Zarqawi.
And he eventually did. We're talking with a man who calls himself Matthew Alexander for obvious reasons of security. He's written a new book, How to Break a Terrorist. If you'd like to talk with him about what works and what doesn't in interrogations, if you've been an interrogator, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And why don't we begin with Vincent, and Vincent calling us from I-95, a major highway along the East Coast.
Yes, hello. Mr. Cohn, thank you for taking my call, and long-time listener. I had a question for Mr. Alexander. I'm a Iraq War veteran myself, and I was told that among the large amounts of detainee population that currently exist, as a result of the Abu Ghraib incident, we can't really have any interrogations amongst a large majority of them. And I was wondering what Mr. Alexander feels if that's been a sort of going overboard in our response to Abu Ghraib, and how he feels that might affect the outcome of the Iraq war and possible security implications there. And thank you for taking my call, and I'll take my call off the air.
All right, drive carefully, Vincent.
That's a good question. I think every person that we capture has some type of intelligence value if they were involved in the insurgency. The question is, how do you know that? I tell the story in the book of one young man who was captured with some paraphernalia from videos that were on CDs. And we eventually unwound him and found out that this was the guy who was the Al-Qaeda web developer. He took what we call chop shop videos, the videos of beheadings and of suicide bombings, and put them onto video, and then created those as propaganda for Al-Qaeda. And this guy, you know, if we had not suspected that he could have been somebody more important, just said, well, he's just a guy with, you know, some bad CDs or some propaganda, we would have never known that. So to answer your question, yes, everybody that we detain that we suspect, we should interrogate to find out if they have intelligence value.
We're talking with a former interrogator in Iraq who calls himself Matthew Alexander about his new book, How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Used Brains, Not Brutality, to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. 800-989-8255. If you'd like to join us, email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. They call themselves Gators, the military interrogators trained to elicit information from suspects in Iraq. Matt Alexander, a pseudonym, was flown to Iraq back in 2006 as part of a group of interrogators that joined an elite team charged to find Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq. Matthew Alexander is talking with us today in Studio 3A. His book is called How to Break a Terrorist. If you'd like to read the first chapter about his first days in the Gator Pit, head over to our website at npr.org. If you have a question about interrogations, what works, what doesn't, if you've been an interrogator, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website, npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. And let's go now to Conrad. Conrad with us from St. Augustine in Florida.
Hi, I'm just calling. I'm a former interrogator myself in the first Gulf War. But I'm wondering whether this book that says, you know, how to break a terrorist won't compromise our future efforts by, you know, having Al-Qaeda come up with a book for themselves, how to withstand future interrogations.
You obviously, Matthew Alexander, ran into suspects who had been trained how to defy interrogations, the standard of the people, the kind that the people before you were using. And I guess Conrad's got a good question.
Right. And, you know, the Department of Defense made the decision years ago to unclassify the field manual of interrogations that lists the techniques that are legal. But my background is criminal investigations, and in the criminal investigative world, the techniques are unclassified. You can turn on the TV any night, and you can see detectives working on any number of TV shows and see them using techniques. Yet somehow, even though criminals are exposed to these and learn them, the detectives are still successful day in and day out.
Good cop, bad cop still works.
Correct. And the reason why is because they still need something. The person sitting on one side of the room still needs something, and the interrogator still needs something. So there has to be a negotiation, a compromise, whether or not they know what technique you're using or not. Really, though, It's up to the interrogator to come up with, to be innovative and to use the techniques in new ways. And that's some of the things I talk about in my book, is how my team and I used methods that were well known by Al-Qaeda, but we put little twists on them. And we made them better and improved them and came up with new ways of interrogating. So I make the analogy of a football game. Both sides know that there's rules. Both sides know that there's certain types of plays you can run. But it doesn't mean one side has an advantage and can win. It's up to the ability and the intellect of the other side.
Conrad, does that fit with your experience?
Well, yeah. I mean, you want to play to somebody's, like you said, play to somebody's needs, you know. And again, I've had a lot of education and background in Middle Eastern studies. So, you know, that helps, certainly. But again, I'm just, you know, of course, I haven't read the book. Didn't even know it existed. I just listened to NPR. You know, but, you know, you can write a book on, you know, how to make a dirty bomber and stuff that is available out there on the internet. You can use that, but I don't think it's really, probably the less that's out there, probably the better.
All right, Conrad. Thanks, sir. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
No problem.
Let's see if we can go now to this is Bill. Bill on the line with us from Chicago in Illinois.
Yes. Good afternoon. Fascinating topic. I wanted to ask Mr. Alexander, what sort of strategies or defensive measures do you use to prevent your captive from getting too far inside your head and turning the interrogation against you? Because I remember hearing another NPR story with a former military interrogator who, after an interrogation that got deeply personal, left military intelligence altogether because he could no longer delineate the terrorist from himself. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
All right, Bill, thank you.
It's a great question. I advocate that one of the best techniques was not to fight that, to let the detainee believe that he was converting you. You know, within Islam, if you convert an infidel to Islam, that's a free ticket to heaven. And many Muslims believe this. So a lot of my detainees were very surprised, first of all, to find out that I had read the Quran. And I often brought a copy of the Quran, a personal copy of the Quran, into the interrogation booth and showed them passages that I was interested in or discussed it with them. And then they'd take that interest and they'd try to convert me to Islam, and I'd play along. The interrogation is not about trying to win. It's necessarily. It's about trying to convince the other person to be cooperative. And so I actually think it's a great strategy to allow them to try to convert you or try to convince you or try to get inside of your head. As the interrogator, it's incumbent upon you, though, to always keep the end goal in mind.
Here's an email from Chuck in Portland. It's been made very clear that many of these interrogations violated international law and constitute war crimes. Warrants are being issued worldwide for arrest of these American interrogators. The new administration has promised to prosecute many of these cases. Does your guest have any thoughts regarding the war crimes he has committed? This Chuck's words, not mine, and whether or not he will go to prison for committing them.
Yeah, I never broke the rules of an interrogation while I was in Iraq, and I would not allow any of my team members to break the rules. I know
the rules as set out in the Army Field Manual.
That's correct, and as set out in Geneva Conventions. All interrogators are trained on Geneva Conventions before we arrive.
Did other people that you saw interrogate people in Baghdad abide by those rules?
I've chosen not to focus on that subject. I did see breaking of the rules. And I did report those. But that's not the focus of my book or of what I'm saying, because I'm a military officer, ultimately, and my job isn't to point out the broken wheel, it's to fix it. And enough has been written about abuse and torture and that they don't work and what we've suffered because of their use. I think we need to focus now on the way forward, and that's why I write my book and tell stories about how new interrogation methods are more effective and how we need to change the system.
You identify no other interrogators or indeed anybody else in the military by name and rank with one exception, and that was General Casey, who was then the ground commander in Iraq, and he came by at one point at a meeting. You got up and said, "Wait a minute, our perception of these Sunnis is incorrect. Maybe some of them are people who are opposed to Al Qaeda in Iraq. They just had no choice but to go to them. If we give them an alternative, they may come over to our side." And you say he blew you off, and indeed, you've written that General Petraeus, a year afterwards, used some of those same techniques in the Anbar Awakening.
And Neil, I don't know what was going through General Casey's mind. To my reply, he said, "Humph," which I'm not sure how to interpret that. I'm not sure if that meant I don't agree with you, or noted, and maybe I'll take some action on it. But I do know that we had no policy to work together with Sunnis while I was in Iraq. It was people were actually the attitude towards Sunnis was very negative. And it took General Petraeus and people that worked before General Petraeus, some Marines in Ramadi, had actually first started this process of reaching out to Sunnis and saying we can work together even if they've committed crimes against other Iraqis or against Americans. And that process, you know, facilitated the Anbar Awakening, which dramatically dropped violence in Iraq.
Let's get Ed on the line. Ed with us from the Twin Cities in Minnesota.
Yes. I'm from a different era with different training, but there. My question is this. In my situation, we were well-trained in the culture. We were well-trained in the language. We basically, when we had someone we needed to interrogate, we did not have stringent time constraints. Given those factors, if you are under tremendous time constraints, does that alter significantly the amount of force that may be required to break a recalcitrant?
Well, let's take a look at that. There's two ways to look at this. There's a morality issue on torture, and there's a pragmatic issue. And the pragmatic issue can be broken down into short-term and long-term. Let's say that you have a guy who could give you information, and the only way you're going to get that is by torturing him. And let's say you decide to torture, you get that information, and you stop a terrorist attack. Now, this is a situation that we were in every interrogation in Iraq. We were trying to stop suicide bombings. Some of the people that we faced off with in the interrogation booth had literally been caught with suicide bombers. Some had been caught right after the suicide bombers had walked out the door, and we'd missed them. We were in the ticking time bomb scenario every day in Iraq. But for the short term, we knew that if we tortured, yeah, we might stop one bomber. But now Al-Qaeda is going to use that against us to recruit fighters. And now down the road, a year, 2 years from now, we're going to have to stop another 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 terrorists. So it's counterproductive in the long run towards winning the war to use torture. Now let's go over to the morality argument. Torture for me is simply un-American. It's against American principles. It's against what we stand for. George Washington forbade his troops from torturing prisoners of war. Abraham Lincoln forbade his troops from torturing prisoners of war. And there's a reason for that, because they were abiding by the principles upon which his country was founded on.
You mistake two things here. One, you were dealing with tactical assets as opposed to strategic assets. And I think there is a difference here. You were dealing, yes, you were under time constraints, but these were relatively low-level people. But when we're talking about the strategic folks, some of the sheikhs and things, I think you have a different situation there.
Well, I think some of the people he's writing about were more than tactical. If you're thinking about Abu Musab al-Zarqawi as strategic, the guy running al-Qaeda in Iraq, at one point the most wanted man next to Osama bin Laden in the world.
Yeah, let me address that. The people that we had in Iraq at my prison were the highest ranking members of al-Qaeda in Iraq. They were almost all of them were strategic and had strategic information. And in fact, the person that ultimately gave us Zarqawi, you know, there's some information I don't write about in the book because I believe it should stay classified about strategic information that we received. But the torture argument, it holds the same, whether you're talking about strategic or tactical information, because torture recruits for al-Qaeda, which hurts our effort in the long run. And secondly, I don't care if it's tactical, operational, or strategic information that you're getting, it's still immoral, and it's against American principles.
Thank you.
Ed, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
We're talking with a man who calls himself Matthew Alexander. For security reasons, he writes under a pseudonym, along with John Bruning. They're the co-authors of a new book called How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Use Brains and Not Brutality to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And it's interesting to me, you write, what makes a good interrogator? Well, interrogation, you say, is like acting. And as you're feeling somebody out, you're deciding which persona to adopt.
Yeah, I call it the doppelganger. You have to be able to transform yourself in each interrogation. The worst interrogators I had were people who could only play one role. And whether that role was sympathetic or whether it was, being the hard ass, they were very limited in their usefulness. The best interrogators I had could be anybody. Bobby, the interrogator that started with me at the beginning, was extremely versatile. One day he could be your best friend, and the next day he could be a real hard ass. He was almost like a one-man good cop, bad cop.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Bill. Bill calling us from Wiesbaden in Germany.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question for Mr. Alexander. That is, when you were making assurances to Sunnis that you were interrogating, did you have the feeling that those assurances were going to get backup from policymakers in Iraq or back in Washington? I sometimes, when reading a little bit into American history, whether it be Vietnam or Cuba or other places, had the feeling that sometimes assurances are made that Washington then does not back up on. I would like to hear your answer to that question.
Bill?
I wished that I could have backed up every promise that I made when I was interrogating people, especially in the case of Abu Hayder, the person who gave us Zarqawi. Here was a man who could have played a role in the future of Iraq in terms of a friendship with us, even though he had hated us at one point and participated in attacks against us. But as an interrogator, you can make promises that you can't keep. That's perfectly within the rules. The reason it's harmful is if that person, you don't keep the promise, then someone else has to interrogate them down the road. They're not going to have faith in them because they would have been lied to once. But also remember that there are some ways to keep promises. For instance, when people do cooperate with us and they later go before a panel of judges for sentencing, the panel of judges certainly take into account the fact whether or not somebody's been cooperative and will give people more leniency who are.
Bill?
Yeah, I'm there. Okay, well, thank you very much for your answer.
Okay, thanks for the phone call.
Yeah, bye-bye.
And here's an email from Matthew in Salt Lake City. I've often heard that the small-scale cells the terrorists use to operate are prohibitive, as when captured they know little or nothing about wider operations of the cause they fight for. To what extent is that true? How does one manage limited information coming from interrogations in order to make it practical?
That's a great question. It's a serious challenge in interrogations when you have compartmentalized information on the part of the enemy. Ultimately, as the interrogator, you try to get every piece of information you can out of a detainee, and then you pass that to analysts. The analysts put the pieces of the puzzle together. And we have superb analysts working for us in the United States, military and in our government. And the work that they do is just crucial to be able to putting these pieces together. So as an interrogator, you just get everything you can, and you pass it up to the analysts and let them put the pieces of the puzzle together. But the other part of this is that you never know what somebody is hiding. And, I call the book How to Break a Terrorist. But break is a term that we use as interrogators to just mean that you get a little piece of something. It's like cracking an egg. And usually we use it to refer to the first time that you get somebody to cooperate, because that's the most important.
Finally, we just have a minute with you left. But do you feel that the lessons that you learned in Iraq and these new methods of interrogation, do you think that these have been adopted? Are these the techniques being used today?
There are interrogators who are still using these techniques today. I passed on my thoughts before I left to how we could better train our interrogators. I put out a list of techniques that are used in the criminal world that we should be using. But I think, it would be it would be great if the next administration would put together a team of experienced criminal investigators to teach our intelligence interrogators some of those techniques.
Thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate
it. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Again, a gentleman calls himself Matthew Alexander, writing under a pseudonym along with co-author John Bruning. The book is called How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Used Brains, Not Brutality, to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. And he joined us here in Studio 3A. Coming up, NPR's ombudsman Alicia Shepard joins us to talk about NPR's funding credits and complaints about how they may or may not influence programming. That's next. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We'll be right back.